If you've got your outlines, they say Stairway to Heaven on the front. You know, many of you were very, very excited this morning that we might have some Led Zeppelin music and all that kind of stuff. And actually, no, this is actually a reference to a Bible story. A guy named Jacob actually has a Stairway to Heaven type of experience. I actually think Led Zeppelin probably ripped it off from the Bible. But Jacob's life, and that's who we're going to be talking about a little bit this morning. If you've got your Bibles, you should open them up to Genesis chapter 27. Genesis chapter 27. Genesis first book, 27, just in there a little bit, about just over halfway through the book of Genesis. Genesis 27, we're going to be talking about the life of Jacob. And Jacob's life is in a very typical pattern for Old Testament. In the Old Testament, it is not uncommon for God to make a promise to people and then for those same people to do something catastrophically foolish or stupid even. You would even say, why in the world, after getting this promise from God, would they have this kind of a faithless response? You need look no further than your mirror to find out why, because this is kind of how we are, isn't it? God makes His promises to us, and then we go and do something foolish or stupid. We can all look at things in our past, or many of us, things in our present, that have gone on, that we look at the promises of God in the Bible, and then we look at our response to the promises of God, and you could probably even think to yourself, why am I this way? Why do I keep doing the very thing that I do not want to do? Well, Jacob is that kind of a person in the Old Testament. He has received the promise. He understands his fathers, Abraham and Isaac. And he is the Jacob of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But up to this point, all he has are the promises of his father. And he goes about doing something catastrophically stupid. Do you remember? Not only did he kind of connive the birthright out of his brother, but then he involved himself in a deceptive scheme to receive his father's blessing. It was a complex, overtly deceptive scheme. It wasn't like he just got caught in a little lie. This was huge. He had done something that made his brother so angry that his brother was murderously angry with him. I doubt that most of us in the room, I mean, I know probably some of you threatened to kill your brother and sister when you were younger, but I doubt that most of us in the room actually entertain serious notions of how to kill your brother or sister. And I doubt that many of us had gone to the lengths that Esau had where he had communicated it to the community at large. As soon as mom and dad are dead, Jacob's going down. And that's kind of what he had communicated. And so the word was out. And Rebecca, Jacob's mother, said, you need to get out of Dodge. You need to get out of town because your brother is going to kill you as sure as the sun rises. And so she went to her husband, Isaac, and she said, we don't want Jacob marrying one of the local girls. Look at him. Look, Esau's married a local girl. We don't want that for our son Jacob, who has the blessing and the birthright. Let's send him back to the land of our fathers. Let's send him up to my brother Laban. And let's see if he can find a wife up there. And so Isaac, who is resigned now to Jacob having the birthright, blesses Jacob and sends him on his way. It both served the purpose of getting him a wife and it served the purpose of getting him out of Esau's crosshairs so that Esau would not kill his slightly younger brother. This is in the pattern of things where there's a promise, the person does something catastrophically stupid. This is in the refining now period. Oftentimes you find that after God has made the promise, after the person has done something stupid, they are sent away for a period of time. Sometimes it's 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, 80 years, where the person literally goes through wandering. But this is a time of refinement. This is a time of training. God oftentimes does not speak a great deal to the person during this time. He sets them to a task to really go through a process that is leading them to maturity, like walking up a stairway. They are being taken in the direction of maturity. And I wonder, as we walk through this morning, and we've got a lot of ground to cover, I wonder, where are you in this process? So we have a lot of different storylines in our lives, and some of them intersect and some of them don't. But I wonder where you are in the process of this whole thing. Have you understood the promises of God in your life? Have you yourself failed in living up to the standard that God has called you to? Have you done something catastrophically stupid? Are you in the process of maturing? I know I am, and I was challenged by Jacob's life as I've been studying it in these previous weeks. And so this morning, as we look at this, I want you to constantly be asking yourself, where am I? Where am I in the process of what God is doing in my life? Have I viewed just the common everyday occurrences of my life in the context of what is God doing with me? Because I guarantee you, God is in the process of maturing you for something that is greater than anything you can imagine. See, God chooses people to involve them in His story, and His story is greater than anything that any one person can accomplish. And that means God is working out faith in you, those of you that have trusted in Him for your whole life. God is working out something great in you for something that is even greater than you can imagine. You might think that the purpose of your life is so that you can pass it along to your kids. You might think that the purpose of your life is so that you can make great investments to bless future generations. And I'm telling you, what God has in mind for your life is greater than anything that you can possibly imagine. And we're going to see that in the life of Jacob this morning. So if you've got your Bibles, again, open them up to Genesis. Did I have you in chapter 27? I think I did. Chapter 27 was Jacob's deception. Now he leaves. Now we're in chapter 28. Jacob is sent away and he heads out towards the land of Haran to his uncle Laban. By the way, the word Laban, that name, means white. That will come into play later. Laban perhaps was very pale skinned, and so, especially at his birth. And so because he was so pale skinned, you know, parents didn't have a lot of creativity with the whole name thing. It wasn't like, you know, get the name book and, you know, it was like, oh, he looks white. What are we going to name him? Laban. That means white, okay? In the language, in the original language, it means white. And so they just named him Whitey, all right? So there you go. That's Laban. Stopping for sleep, though, along the way to Haran to go see his Whitey uncle, Jacob dreams about a ladder which connects the heavens and the earth. He has this dream about angels traveling up and down this ladder and God standing at the top of it. And in the dream, God speaks to Jacob. This is the first time that he speaks to Jacob about the covenant promise of land, descendants, and blessing. In chapter 28, top of the next page, letter C, Jacob names the location Beit El, or Bethel. In English, we call it just simply Bethel. Break that apart, and it is Beit, which means house, and El, which means God. In other words, it is the house of God. That's what he names the place, because this is the location that God has chosen to step down out of heaven and step down onto earth. And he makes a vow to God, which I think is profound. In chapter 28, starting in verse 20, Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me, I want you to follow along. If you've got your Bibles, this is important. Follow along. Verse 20, chapter 28, Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and you could throw in the word if here. And if I return to my father's house in safety. Now, most of your Bibles will make a transition here. There is an if-then clause that is going on. It's repetitive all the way through. And it probably says in your Bible, then the Lord will be my God. As though if all of these things happen, then I, Jacob, will give my commitment to the Lord. In actuality, that's probably a poor reading of how this has actually been written. I'm going to extend the if-and clause a little bit and read it differently, starting in verse 21. If I return to my father's house in safety, and if the Lord will be my God. In other words, if God will show himself faithful along the road, then this stone, verse 22, which I have set up as a pillar, this will be God's house. In other words, I am leaving this place, and if God will be faithful to me, and this vow that he makes is completely dependent on God, read back through it again at some point and see just how dependent on God's actions Jacob is. He pretty much lays everything on God. He says, if all of this happens, then when I come back to this stone that I have set up as a pillar, this will be called God's house. And all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. In other words, I will, popularly called tithe, I will tithe back a tenth of everything that is given to me. And so God, in His promise to Jacob, sends him on his way. And he gets to Haran in chapter 29. He arrives in Haran. This is number 2, letter A. And he falls in love with the first girl he sees, Rachel. He flirts with her. You know, he shows up at a well. This is a great story. You should read it there in chapter 29. He shows up at a well, and there's a bunch of guys sitting there. And they're waiting to water their sheep. And they're waiting for the group to come that can actually lift the lid off of the well. And then Rachel shows up. And it says, she was exceedingly beautiful. Now see, Jacob had no reason to lift the lid off the well because he didn't have anything to water. He didn't have flocks and everything else. But then Rachel shows up, and now she's waiting. And so what does Jacob do? Boom! He just walks over to that lid, and all by himself, it says, he lifts the lid off. And you can just see it, right? You know, getting in the position next to Rachel. Where will she see these biceps, you know? And he picks that thing up, and Rachel notices. It even says that on their very first meeting, he walked up to her and he kissed her. Now that was not like, you know, a date or any kind of a passionate kiss. That meant that he went up to her and he kissed her on the cheek. And then he finds out that her dad is who? Laban, the very guy that he came up to find. And so he is delighted. After working about a month in Laban's home, he says, "Can I work for you for 7 years in order to win your daughter Rachel as my wife?" Now, just so you know, that was local custom. You shouldn't be all that offended. You got to remember that this was a very different time. I know some of you ladies are like, "So what? He worked for her and she was like his property?" Yes, that's exactly how it worked back then. That's kind of how it went. You know, dad gave you away, and you were kind of transferred property-wise from one to the other. Today, it's more of a security thing. You know, when I stand up here, when brides come down the aisle, who do they walk down with generally? They walk down with their fathers. And I ask that profound question at the beginning of the ceremony. Who gives this woman to be married to this man? And the father will respond, "Her mother and I do." And there is a profound moment in every wedding where that man that is standing next to me steps up to the father and shakes hand. And it is a transferring of the mantle of security that has laid over her life that her father has provided. He is now stepping back and he is handing her hand away to this young man. And that mantle now lies on him. He is now shifting and he has become her protector. So that in our culture is so romantic, right? Like we're all like, that's so neat for us to hear in our modern wedding ceremony. It's the same kind of thing that is going on here. He is offered to work for 7 years for Rachel. And it's filled with romance. Look at chapter 29, verse 20. "So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her." He worked hard. He worked for 7 years to win the hand of Rachel, and it was filled with romance for him. It just seemed like a few days of work because he could look longingly on Rachel. And they went through this extended period of courtship. And so Jacob says to Laban in verse 21, "I'm ready. I've served my 7 years. Will you give me her hand in marriage?" At which point Laban doesn't really say yes, but he says, "I will begin a wedding feast." Now, a wedding ceremony in their culture took a whole week. And at some point during that week, the father would bring the daughter to the young man that he was going to be marrying, and she literally would go into his tent and they would consummate on that evening the wedding. It could happen on day 1. It generally happened on day 7. All right? It could happen at any point during the week, but generally it happened at the last possible moment during the week. The guy knew that by the 7th day he would have a wife, but he knew that it could happen any day in between. In the meantime, there was a huge celebration that went on. Shockingly, letter C, Laban brings his oldest daughter to Jacob. Now see, Laban had 2 daughters. Leah, who it says she had bad eyes. That could be something physical, meaning her eyes were all screwed up. Or it probably means that her eyes were just weak. She couldn't see very well. She couldn't run down to Lens Crafters and that, you know, culture or anything like that. So if she was a little, she couldn't see anything. And then there was Rachel, who was beautiful in form and beautiful in every way, according at least to Jacob. And so Laban brings his oldest daughter, Leah, the one with the bad eyes, to Jacob. And then, in one of the weirder passages, and this happens a few times in the Bible, Jacob sleeps with Leah, but he doesn't know that it's Leah until the next morning. How is that possible? How could that happen? I'm sure some of you have read that and you're like, that's a major boo-boo, all right? That's like, how do you sleep with somebody and then you're like, whoa, hey, who are you? You know, that kind of thing. Once again, the deceiver has been deceived by his own family. You remember I said before, he deceived his brother, he deceived his father, he will get it back tenfold. And here is that moment in his life. He wakes up in the morning, he looks across the bed, and who does he see? Not the girl that he's been working for, not the one that he had the agreement around. He sees her older sister laying there next to him, like, hi, is that you? You know, that kind of thing. I mean, she's laying, it's Leah. And so he barges out. Now, how could that happen? There's a few, I think, good explanations. One, you got to remember, there were not lights back in this culture, okay? In ancient Haran, there were no lights. So when it became nighttime, it was nighttime, all right? It was darker than dark. Inside of a tent, we're talking pitch black. The kind of pitch black where you put your hand in front of your face and you can't even see it. So it was extremely dark. But that probably isn't enough, right? They probably would have said something to each other or something like that. So here's another part. Part of the local custom was that the woman was heavily veiled. Heavily, heavily veiled. Like multiple veils across her face. All that she could see out were her eyes probably when she had her full wedding garb on. So she was heavily veiled. So even if he could have seen her, what would he have seen? Her dim eyes. That was it. That was all that he would have been able to see of his bride. But it was very dark inside of the tent. But even so, even given all of that, it still seems kind of strange that they wouldn't have had some sort of conversation. I asked a question earlier. How could a person sleep with somebody and then the next morning look across the bed and think, whoa, I didn't know it was you? How would that happen in our culture when someone was drunk? I've talked to people. Yeah. All right. I've talked to people that have been like, you know, I had too much to drink and then the worst happened. I must have slept with this girl because I woke up in the morning, and there she was next to me. And I didn't even remember any of it. I don't remember. I must have been totally out of it. I believe that the reason that Laban gives his daughter away on the first night, and by the way, you'll note that right down there in verse 24, it said, there's just this little break in the narrative in verse 24 of chapter 29. It says, Laban also gave his made Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. This was customary practice to give a maiden or a handmaiden to the bride-to-be right before she would consummate the relationship with her husband. And so from Leah's perspective, this was all on the up and up. From her perspective, she was going in to her husband. Her father was giving her away. Some transaction had occurred. Something had happened where he had agreed to marry her. She had been given a maid. She was complicit to the extent that this was what you were supposed to do in that culture. So she goes in to sleep with her husband and wakes up in the morning and finds out, I'm not the one that he wanted. So what we've got here are some, you know, off the charts, horrible family dynamics. But understand, I believe that the reason that he was given away, or she was given away on Monday, was because Laban was waiting for the night that Jacob had too much to drink. At some point, he knew during that week, he was going to have too much to drink. And when he was good and schnookered, I'm going to slip in the older daughter. So Jacob comes out of the tent and he is hacked. He says, Laban, why have you deceived me? Was it not for Rachel that I served? Verse 25, why then have you deceived me? And Laban shoots right back at him. It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week for this one. In other words, complete this wedding week with this one, Leah. And we will give you the other one also for the service which you shall serve me with for another 7 years. What has Laban done? He squeezed 7 more years of service out for the other daughter who he was going to give him the whole time anyway. So Laban really has deceived him, but he is going to give him Rachel. And by the way, he didn't work 7 years and then get Rachel. He got Rachel at the end of the week. All right, after the week was done with Leah, he received a second wife a week later. Think about that. That's so different than our culture, isn't it? And the fact that the father was complicit in the entire thing, and the fact that these two were sisters, that would be forbidden later in the law that God would describe to the people. But up to this point, it was still okay. Because God had not told them, don't do that yet. And so they didn't know. And so here he is. He's married to two sisters, the older sister and the younger sister. Sisters, would you enjoy having the same husband? Holy mackerel, that would just be a lousy family situation, huh? And to feel like your older sister had kind of slipped herself into the tent, so to speak, at the last moment, on the first day of the wedding ceremony that you thought was going to be for you, this is bad news. When confronted, Laban says, hey, this is just local custom. It begs the question, why didn't they talk about this in advance, though? He clearly deceived him. But he is given Rachel as his wife at the end of the week. Jacob was feeling rage, but becomes conciliatory in his emotions. Jacob finishes the week, and in Genesis 29:30, it says that Jacob loved Rachel more than he loved Leah. There's favoritism that is immediately played out in the family. And just so you know, you should circle that verse. That is heavy-duty foreshadowing for what's going to happen in the future. There will be a son named Joseph eventually. And he will be a heavily favored son. And it will cause total havoc in this family. And we'll talk about him in September. Number three, top of the next page. Now here we go. Jacob is a busy man. And he is about to have a whole pile of kids. Having mercy for Leah's plight, the fact that she is not loved as much, God gives her children. And it's kind of a sad episode, but Leah continues to pump out kids, and she does that in order to win the love of her husband. After each child, she says, now I have 2 kids, he'll certainly love me. Now I have 3 children, now I've provided him with 4 children. Now certainly he will love me. And it seems that Jacob never really gives his love to Leah. But she produces 6 sons for him, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Rachel, remember, the loved one, she's jealous of her older sister's blessing, and God has closed up Rachel's womb. She can't have kids. So, as was customary, she gives her handmaiden that was given to her at the wedding, Bilhah, to Jacob as a surrogate mother and says, I'll have children through Bilhah. And Jacob, being the compliant guy that he was, has 2 more children, Dan and Naphtali, through Bilhah. Leah, in the meantime, has stopped having kids, and she sees that, and so she gives her handmaiden, Zilpah, to Jacob. Jacob, again, being the good guy that he is, sleeps with her too, and he has 2 children from that arrangement, Gad and Asher. Eventually, God hears the voice of Rachel, and he gives her a son of her own, and Rachel's first son is named Joseph. Joseph. You ever heard of Joseph before? One of the most famous, best-loved characters in all of the Old Testament, who we're going to spend a great deal of time talking about, starting with the school year in September. And then, of course, much later, Rachel gets pregnant again. And this is after Joseph has already gone to Egypt. Rachel gets pregnant again, and she dies in childbirth, having her final son, and the final of the 12 sons of Jacob, And that son's name is Benjamin. So those are all the sons that Jacob has through the wives and handmaidens that he was married slash surrogate married to through his relationships out there with Laban. He spends some 20 years serving Laban for his wives and for the flocks that are built up. And all of this is kind of multiplication that is occurring. He thinks he's getting one wife. He ends up with what? Two. And he gets two handmaidens, too. And so he's having children through four. And so it's just multiplication going on all over the place. He's got multiplied wives. Now he's got multiplied kids. And his wealth is also multiplying at the same time. After the birth of Joseph, number four, letter A, Jacob asks Laban to depart. He wants to go back to Canaan now. Laban objects, though, because he has had a vision that God has told him, the reason that you're so wealthy is because you have my blessed one, Jacob, in your midst. So Laban, reluctantly, letter B, asked Jacob what he wants for his wages. And he can hardly believe his good fortune when Jacob says, I will take all of the runts of all of the goats and all the sheep. I just want all the speckled, mottled ones. I'll take all the ones that are kind of messed up, that don't look all that good. You keep all the pure black ones. You keep all the white ones. But I just want the goofy looking ones. Now God had given this to him in a dream. And you see Jacob go through this elaborate method of trying to get these goats and sheep, you know, separately to mate with one another. He puts little white sticks in front of them. There's a whole lot of play on words that goes through this. There's white poplar branches and white strips. And, you know, he works for who? White guy. And all this kind of, and there's all this white going on. And what does God do? It says, and Laban totally gives God the credit for all of this, even though he uses his best knowledge in multiplying all of these sheep. Letter D, top of the next page. Jacob clearly gives credit to God for multiplying all of his wealth and all of the flocks. And this just makes Laban more angry. Laban's like, I'm losing here on all sides. I'm doing everything I can to minimize the amount of stuff this guy can take. And he just keeps getting more. God just keeps blessing him. Jacob, sensing this hostility, hearing God's voice to go, flees Haran, where Laban lives, with his wives, his children, and the substantial flocks and holdings that he has. But he doesn't tell Laban. This is typical of Jacob. It's actually typical of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that they are a little bit scared of confrontation. Jacob, though, is extremely scared of it, and he runs. Unfortunately, he's not running alone. It's very difficult to run with hundreds upon thousands of sheep, goats. You've got 12 sons, some of whom are still nursing, and you've got two wives and really two concubines, that, and all of them are caring for children. You can imagine, think about trying to get from here to San Francisco with that troop, right? You can imagine what it must have been like for him to go across open country, no paved roads, no cars. They're just traveling out there like nomads. And then the bad news comes, Laban is coming and he's got 400 men with him. Laban's not traveling with any wives. Laban's not traveling with any flocks. Laban's coming with 400 fighting men so that he can overtake poor Jacob. So Laban pursues Jacob, but on the way he is told by God, don't curse him, don't harm him, neither bless him nor help him. In other words, Jacob is mine. You are to have nothing to do with him. You cannot harm him, or I will harm you. Do not bless him, or help him, or I will harm you. Have nothing to do with him. And so Laban catches up. They have this rather kind of testy exchange. And then they, at the very end of it, agree to exchange a covenant, something called the Mizpah covenant. Have you ever seen those coins that young people wear sometimes? It's a coin and it's got a crack right through the middle of it. And I must admit, normally, in fact, almost in all occasions that I can recall, girls wear these, okay? It's kind of sentimental. And, you know, one girl will wear one half of the coin, and the other girl will wear the other half of the coin. And if you put the two pieces together, you can read the whole verse. And that verse is recorded right in Genesis chapter 31, 49. Genesis 31:49. This is the covenant of Mizpah. May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. Best friends often wear these little coins, even modern day. The Mizpah covenant. This was made between Laban and Jacob because Laban was so angry with Jacob and he wanted him to never return, but he wanted to make sure that he still retained the blessing that God had emptied out on Jacob. There's really no reason for him to believe that that would happen. This was his desperate attempt at keeping the blessing for himself. But it allowed Jacob to leave, and they set up a pillar in between them, and it basically said that Laban would never pursue him beyond this pillar with hostility in his heart, and that Jacob was never allowed to come back and go past that pillar with hostility in his heart, and that that meeting point in the middle would be the area of separation for the two of them, and they would leave from that point friends. And that is the Mizpah covenant. And now Jacob is free to go back into the land. And so he journeys back towards Bethel, where he had told the Lord, I'm setting up a pillar, and if you are faithful to me, and if you will stay with me, and if you will provide for me, then I will come back to this pillar, and you, this pillar will become the house of God, and I will give you a tenth of all that I have. He has been multiplied in his wives. He's been multiplied in his children. He has been multiplied in his holdings and in his wealth so fantastically that he has become a mighty, mighty man. So after 20 years, he returns to Canaan, but he is filled with fear. Because when he left, his brother Esau wanted to kill him. And that night, filled with fear, he goes off to be alone. And in chapter 32, verse 24, it says that Jacob was left alone, and then a man came to him and wrestled with him until the break of day. I want you to picture what this must have been like. It is pitch dark. He is in terror for his life, so much so that he goes off to be alone. And then he hears something. And then someone grabs him out of the dark and immediately begins to put the squeeze down onto Jacob. Can you imagine what that must have been like? It was like a nightmare coming true for him. And so immediately Jacob begins to fight back. And he cannot get out of the hold of whoever it is that's got him. And whoever it is that's got him won't say anything. And it's completely pitch black. And he doesn't know who it is. And so through the entire night, these two are wrestling with one another. And Jacob is desperately trying to get away. In the darkest of night, this unknown assailant attacks him, and it lasts all night long. As daybreak nears, the man finally speaks and says, hey, the sun is about to rise. You need to let me go so that I can leave. Why would he say something like that? It just seems bizarre. To be honest with you, the first time I read it, I thought, oh, he's a vampire. Isn't that funny? Like, daybreak's coming, gotta go. You know, let me leave. And it's one of those weird sounding things, isn't it? Like, what, you can turn to dust? What's going on? Jacob's unknown assailant reaches down, though, and just touches his thigh with a finger. And boom! He dislocates his hip right down there. Just with a finger touch. Jacob grabs onto him, immediately knowing, I've been wrestling against something that is supernatural, and he grabs onto him and he will not let go. He would rather die than let go of whatever has just dislocated his hip. And it says in the book of Hosea that through tears, and you can imagine the pain that he was feeling, Jacob begged this supernatural being to bless him. This unknown man asks finally for Jacob's name. And then in one of the most, I think, magnificent, grace-filled moments in the Bible, verse 28 of chapter 32, this angel, which we're going to find out about in a few verses, says, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. Notice the L at the end, like Bethel, Israel. So God's name is worked in here. For you have striven with God and with men, and have prevailed. You will no longer be called Jacob. So now Jacob knows this isn't just supernatural going on. This is God, because He has renamed me the way that He renamed Abraham. The way that Abram was renamed Abraham, now this man is renaming me. Jacob has become Israel. And Jacob asked him and says, please tell me your name. He says, why do you want my name? That was not just wanting to know who was talking to him. It was wanting to dominate. It was wanting to own the person that was blessing him. And then the man goes away. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been preserved. Why did God want to leave when the sun was coming up? Because no man can see the face of God and live. He was doing it for Jacob's sake. Jacob has now wrestled with the angel, as the Bible says in different places, and he has held on. He has shown himself determined. And instead of being called a usurper, his name is now changed to Israel, which means God strives or God prevails. So that whenever someone would say Israel to Jacob, calling him by his God-given name, they would be speaking of how God would prevail in his life. And now his sons are not the 12 sons of Jacob, they are the 12 sons of Israel. And they would become the 12 tribes of Israel later on in the book. And these sons would be the great fathers of nations that would come out of Israel, the totality of nations, and each one of them the tribes that filled that nation, which we will be able to get to after the story of Joseph. It revealed that it was God with whom Jacob was wrestling. This changes dramatic in his life, and it represents something after the 20 years that he spent out working and working and working. Jacob encounters Esau, and Esau is forgiving. Jacob and Esau reconcile with one another, and he returns to Bethel, and he renames it again. He names it El Beit El. El Bethel. In other words, the God of the house of God. He is saying that God has been the God of my life through and through, and he renames Bethel, that place. God appears to him after he renames the area once more to reinforce his new name, Israel. It would be the beginning, practically speaking, of an entire nation. Well, I have to ask myself, as I come to the end of just this huge, long, meandering story. I mean, you got Jacob's ladder, the stairway to heaven. You've got Jacob wrestling with the angel. You've got all these different things happening over 20 years. You've got all of the narrative with Laban going on. Each one of those would be worth our time to spend a lot of time talking about. But you know what it caused me to ask? At the end of the whole story, I wonder, what kind of a process are you yourself in with the Lord? How is He maturing you? And have you made Him the God of your house? Practically speaking, where does Jacob start his journey? He starts it in a place that he names Bethel, the house of God. Where does he come back to, like a bookend, at the end of his story? He comes back to El Bethel, the God of the house of God. He's saying that God has been the God of my house the whole time, when it was a very small house, just me. And now it is a very large house. I have 12 sons. And they, according to God, will become a nation. And their wives will be the mothers of kings. What has happened in between is that God has worked out His will in Jacob's life all the way along and renamed him Israel. God wins, essentially. God strives. God wins. God is the one that will be the overcomer in the end. And his whole nation of Israel is named out of this man's life. A man who was a deceiver and has been refined into a nation for God beyond his wildest dreams. And Jacob could have never known how it would work out. He would never see what you can see. He would never see David. He would never see all of the future of that nation. He would never see Jesus Christ. He would never see you and me sitting here on this morning, direct spiritual descendants of that moment. What is God doing in your life? And is He the God of your house? Is He the God of your life? Is He the God of your home? Because just as much as God was at work then in the life of Jacob, He is at work now in the life of you and me and our church. So this morning, I have to leave you with these three questions. What process are you engaged in with God? Are you at the promise? Are you at the screw up? Are you at the period of maturity? Are you living a life of faith? What part in that process are you in? And you might obviously be at different places at different times. Are you moving through? Is God taking control of your home, of your house, of your life? What part of the process are you in? What part of the process am I in? In other words, what part of the process is your family in? The family right here that you're sitting with, or the family that you are going home to. Is God the God of your family? And if so, in what way? Is it practically working itself out in our homes? And finally, how is God in His process the God of Long Beach Alliance Church? How is God maturing us as a body of believers, as a family right here, to follow Him in a more effective manner? Could we say that God is the God of this house right here, of this family right here? You know what that's measured by? The faithfulness of His people. So you have an active contribution just by sitting here this morning, just by being a part of this church. The way we live during the week is worship. And it says that we come together to unify ourselves in that worship to the Lord when we gather together. And I wonder, what is it that you and I bring to the table that communicates that worship of God, that He is the God of this house? That is not meant to heap guilt onto you. That is meant to encourage all of us to come along in what God is doing. Because I fully believe with all of my heart that this is a unique time in our church, that this is a unique moment in our lives, that God is doing something awesome and great here, and that He wants to involve every single one of us in the midst of it. It's no mistake that Cambodia is going out. It's no mistake that we're launching a couples ministry soon. It's no mistake that we continue to do things that are just literally involving people in places where God meets them and lives are changed, and it's radical to be a part of. What are you? What are you getting involved in? What are you contributing to what God is doing in the midst of Long Beach Alliance Church? What's going on in your life? A story like Jacob's should encourage each one of us. No matter where we start, even if we start as deceptive nincompoops, God is refining us. He is drawing us. He is calling us. And He will even change your name to go from being the usurper, the deceiver, to Israel. God wins. Can you imagine that He could do it? Not with Jacob, but with you. That's what He's called us to this morning. Blessed be Your name. We sang that earlier. Is it really true in the house? Is it really true in your house, my house, the house that is this church?